Welcome to Pardes Daily, where you get your daily dose of Torah with Pardes faculty. For the next 2 weeks, Pardes is bringing Purim to you. Let's dive in.
Welcome to Pardes Daily. This is Alex Israel from Alon Shavuot. Today, in the lead up to Purim, we embark in a series of 10 exciting podcasts on Megillat Esther, one for each of the 10 chapters of the Megillah. Today, chapter 1. Let me just note that you will probably do best with these podcasts if you can read the chapter first and then listen to the commentary. So let's begin. Chapter 1 plunges us into the colourful pageantry of the Persian royal court as King Ahasuerus throws a 180-day feast. Who has a party, a mishteh, drinking feast, for 180 days? That's 6 months, half a year. And when that's complete, the king makes yet another mishteh, this time just 7 days for all the courtiers and servants in Shushan. What's going on here? There are lots of theories about who Ahasuerus is. Xerxes, if that means anything to you. But we're going to not examine this from the outside history, but from the inner logic, the literary information of the Megillah. And in that case, we can hazard a guess. The Megillah begins Bishnat Shalosh Lemolcho, in the third year of his reign. And Ahasuerus rules from India to Ethiopia, a huge expanse. After he has ascended the throne, it probably takes a year or two to ensure that his rule is secure. I imagine the new emperor embarks on impressive building projects and what have you. And so, in the third year, he invites all his delegates, ambassadors and representatives from all his 127 provinces, who have never met the emperor, but they work for him and see him as their figurehead. It says that he makes this party, L'chol sarav v'avadav chel paras umadai, for all the officers, the courtiers and the army people. And one presumes that delegations come and go throughout these 180 days from every corner of the empire. The days were probably spent at meetings, you know, the equivalent of what people come to meet in the White House about state protocol, taxation, defense and what have you. But we hear about the evenings. The evenings and the nights are for entertainment, the mishteh. It is here that Ahasuerus seeks to indulge and impress. Nothing is spared. The Megillah stresses that this is about wealth, opulence, and indulgence, wine and drinking. As Yoram Chazoni puts it, Shushan is the party. The real drama happens when Vashti, the king's wife, is summoned at the end of this entire spectacle of power. The verse says, L'harot ha'amim v'asorim et yofya, to exhibit her incredible beauty, more grandstanding. And now we hear about the shock. She refuses to come. The king is incensed. And this, as we read throughout chapter 1, turns into a full government crisis where all the 7 advisors of the king are summoned and Vashti ends up being deposed. Now, I want to ask the question, why begin the story here? After all, this whole story about Vashti and the party seems to be so disconnected to the main storyline, which is about the threatened annihilation of the Jews and their surprise survival. There's logic at starting the Megillah chapter 3 with Haman's hatred of Mordechai and the decree against the Jews. Alternately, we could open with Esther's rise to the throne, which is in chapter 2. But this royal feast seems hardly connected. It transpires 3 years before Esther's taken to the palace, a full 9 years before the anti-Semitic decree. Why do we need to hear about all of this? So I'd like to offer 3 answers. Approach number 1. We'd say that this chapter sets the backdrop to the entire story, so we might appreciate what the Jews, and certainly Esther and Mordechai, are up against. Let me explain, let me elaborate. First, the deposition of the queen. What do we learn from chapter 1? That if you dare defy the king, you provoke his rage and you risk your royal position, possibly even your life. And therefore, when we watch Esther in chapter 5 approach the king uninvited, We recall the last queen, Vashti, who tested the king's patience. We appreciate her bravery all the more. But there's much more here. The party describes the ostentatious display of riches. The whole party is essentially exhibitionist in nature. We hear Baharoto in order to show Osher Kavod Malchuto the wealth and the splendor of his reign, Vetikar Tiferet Kedulato, and the beauty of the majesty of his greatness. Vashti's refusal completely deflates Ahasuerus and sends him into a rage. For 6 months, he's devoted himself to an elaboration of his power. And now, at the finale, he has been shown as a laughingstock. So what happens in the story? The king's advisor steps in. How to calm the king? Memuchan, one of his advisors, says to him, Lo al ha-melech levado avta Vashti ha-malka. Queen Vashti has not wronged the king alone, but also all the princes, all the people who are in the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's behavior will become known to all the women, so they'll despise their husbands in their eyes. What's Memuchan doing? He's a clever advisor. There's nothing like appealing to the king's ego. Memuchan knows exactly how to manipulate him. Your Majesty, he says, this is not about you and your wife. It's a national issue. All the nation look to you, Your Majesty, as an example. You teach the world the correct way to handle your wife. And so they end up making a decree which is translated into all the 127 dialects, written in law, spread through the nation post-haste. Liot kol ish sorer beveito medaber b'kilshon amo. Men will control their wives. Women will obey their husbands. And in fact, if husband and wife speak different languages, the woman will be forced to speak her husband's language. You know, it's interesting that the same pattern happens later in the story. There's a man, Mordechai, who angers a powerful official. Again, anger, a sign of ego. Mordechai refuses to bow to Haman. Haman is infuriated, his ego is hurt. And so what does he say? I won't just be angry with Mordechai, but I'm going to be angry with his whole nation, with all the Jews. And then what does he do? He manipulates the king to cast his hatred of the Jews in law, such that they once again send out letters that they're going to destroy all the Jews, just like they got rid of Vashti. In fact, it won't surprise you that the Midrash says that who was Memuchan? It was actually Haman. In other words, what happens with Vashti happens again with Mordechai later in the Megillah. In other words, we see a king whose facade, whose front is his control of 127 provinces. But we see a drama in which everything is about prestige and honor. The king can't even control his wife. His only significant decisions are as a result of manipulation by courtiers. And in this drama, there are two possible populations who are viewed as a threat. First of all, Vashti, and that means women. Women in general need to be controlled. And later, of course, the Jews. If they enrage you, control them, get rid of them. Chapter 1 then sets the scene for the entire story. Of course, the irony will be that in both cases, the Jews are going to survive and become victorious. As regards the women, rather than obeying and being subordinate to her husband, Esther will manipulate King Ahasuerus, and even Haman's wife, Zeresh, will be the one to bring about his downfall. What I'm saying is, this is one way of looking at chapter 1, which really sets the scene. But let's offer two more perspectives, two maybe more spiritual angles. First of all, the Talmud in Megillah Daf Yud Gimel talks about the notion of lahakdim trufa lamaka, that God sometimes presents a cure, a remedy, even before the evil blow has been dealt. And this might explain a little bit of the structure of the Megillah. You see, in chapter 3, we hear about the plan to murder, to commit genocide against the world's Jewish population. Now, this happens in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus. But chapter 2 had already told us of how Esther was crowned. That's going to be the key to averting the decree. It's already in place in the seventh year of Ahasuerus, 5 years before the decree is made. But then, by starting with chapter one, the dethroning, the deposition of Vashti, whose absence allows Esther to become queen, we're now saying that the machinations of salvation have already been seeded. God is already pulling the strings of a future redemption right from the beginning, from the third year of Ahasuerus. From a religious perspective, we then get a glimpse behind the scenes, or if it's Purim, we'd say, behind the mask of history. There's a divine plan, and we start telling the story from the earliest point in time. So that's a second perspective, and here's our final one. In the landscape of Tanakh, Esther is a rather strange book. It's an anomaly. After all the books in Tanakh mention the Jewish people, mention the land of Israel, usually mention some sense of sinning and some sort of punishment. Or God's name doesn't even appear. There doesn't seem to be an overt spiritual message of repentance or national exile and return. And yet, when we read chapter one of the Megillah, the sensitive reader hears echoes of the Jerusalem temple in the choice of language. Chur karpasu techelet, achutz b'chavlei butz v'argaman aglilei kesef v'amudei sheish, mitot zahav v'kesef, arispat b'hat v'sheish v'dar v'socheret. The notion of techelet, the blue thread, argaman, the purple thread, the red thread, the silver and the gold, all of these words are associated with the Mishkan or the Mikdash, the temple, the tabernacle. Ahasuerus seeks to demonstrate his majesty, kavod malchuto, v'yakar tiferet gedulato. And these two words, kavod and tiferet, honor and splendor, are used in Parashat Tetzaveh to describe the high priest's robes. In fact, the Midrash says that Ahasuerus was wearing the priestly robes for the party. And I'm not sure he really was, but I think what they mean to say is to put the two in relationship. I'll say one stage more. Ahasuerus's palace has an outer courtyard and an inner courtyard, and an even inner throne room where Esther enters that inner sanctum. She enters it in a state of fasting to plead for her life and that of her people. Life rather than death. It almost appears to us as a mirror image of the high priest entering fasting into the inner sanctum of the temple, the Holy of Holies, to plead on Yom Kippur for life instead of death. So what does all this mean? Now that's a good question. This has been interpreted in different ways. Some have interpreted it to mean that the Jews in Shushan had begun to see their exilic home as their true homeland. They were naively and tragically unaware that Persia could turn against them. They saw Shushan as their temple. They didn't realize they could be seen as the enemy. They felt so comfortable in Shushan that the royal palace had become a replacement for the temple. And so that's one perspective. Others read this as expressing the idea that Purim was indeed this wake-up call. And it's the temple which lies behind the scenes. The Jews should have been returning to Jerusalem. And it seems like it was possible at this point to return to Jerusalem and rebuild Jerusalem instead of participating in a foreign court where they risked being seen as aliens and foreigners. They should have understood that it was time to return to their homeland, to Jerusalem, yes, and build the temple. So these are three different vantage points of how we might view chapter one as giving us certain perspective on the Purim story. Thank you for joining us today. And next time we're going to continue with chapter two, where we'll speak about some more feminist themes on Esther and some several other intriguing questions. In the meantime, have a wonderful day.
Thank you to our Pardes faculty, and a big thanks to you, our learners. Make sure to check back in every day to stay on track with your learning, and visit www.pardes.org.il for more information about other ways to learn with Pardes.